Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his bikini-wearing red-headed friend, but this time in prose, Duncan Nichol.
We are stuck in a time loop. We should start off this episode with I've Got You, Babe, because I feel like I'm repeating the same episode all over again.
Today we will be reviewing Red Sonja by Gail Simone. Again.
Red Sonja, comma, consumed this time. As in, my life has been consumed by Gail Simone's interpretation of Red Sonja.
It absolutely is. So last episode we looked up at Gail Simone's first ever attempt on the character, the comic Red Sonja, Queen of Plagues. And now we will be looking at Gail Simone's first ever prose novel, Red Sonja, comma, consumed.
Colon, but yes. And all because, Duncan, you were really excited about the release of the Red Sonja movie. Duncan, what do you make of the Red Sonja movie?
I actually haven't seen it yet, despite it being
out. Oh, you haven't seen it yet, huh? We've read two of the same book in a row because you were so excited about the release of a movie and you haven't seen it yet. Is that what I'm hearing?
Listen, we recall these a little bit ahead of time, and I'm waiting for it to come out on, like, DVD or Blu-ray, and then I will see it, because it's not in a cinema near me. But the audience reviews are in, and Geordie, and the critic reviews, and I don't like to put a lot of stock in this, you know, the sort of metric sites, but on Rotten Tomatoes, it has 50% from critics and like 68 from audiences. And I'll tell you now, that is so much better than I was expecting.
I will say, I have enjoyed some movies which are lower than that on Rotten Tomatoes. Why did you call it tomatoes? I'm the American on this podcast.
Just got to even it out.
So, Duncan, I have a lot of thoughts about Red Sonja Consumed, some of which may sound quite similar to the previous episode, but before we go any further, have you been reading anything else this week?
Not much, but I will share the little I have. So, I actually finished this book quite quickly, and I went back over to another pulpy sword and sorcery novel to fill out the time. I read Conan the Freelance by Steve Perry.
Okay.
So, Steve Perry, if you're aware, has written some Star Wars, he's written some Forgotten Realms, he's written some Conan before. He is the guy who wrote the amazing quote, when describing a demon, he said,
yes,
even
yes.
A blind man would see how awesomely male he was. The guy.
So, this guy is a real mercenary writer, writing for Star Wars, writing for Conan. So, when he's writing Conan the Freelance, this is autobiographical, really.
I have never seen it that way, and I'm sure he would be delighted to have that comparison made. He's a very interesting writer, because a lot of time when we talk about pastiche work, I say this all the time. Why is it suddenly sounding weird to me?
Pastiche.
Thank you. When talking about pastiche works, the actual word pastiche means in the style of another author. Steve Perry ain't writing the style of Robert E. Howard. He is writing in his own fantastic Forgotten Realms D&D style ridiculousness. He writes fast, he writes near comical, he writes melodramatic, he writes in with no regard for the world and setting. It's like going into Zamora. Of course, there's a giant forest of tree-dwelling folk who build their villages like
the Desert Kingdom.
Exactly, up in the rooftops. Obviously, there's a swamp filled with mist wizards. Sure. What's that? A zombie pirate, I see. I'm all here for it. What's that? A sexy zombie pirate, if you insist.
Hell yeah.
Very interesting and a really kind of fun comparison to Red Sonja. But that's not the only thing I've read. Geordie, I wanted to share this with you. I can't go into too much details, right, but I'm actually part of another book club now.
What?
I got into talking about like wanting to expand my leadership skills and my ideas about project management. And I got recommended a book from my boss's boss because I was having this great chat. And it was called, like, The Art of the Scrum. about agile training,
okay,
and how to be a scrum leader, and now I have been brought into the leadership book club, where we get together every once a month and discuss books about leadership techniques and project management techniques, and it's something special.
Duncan, please never talk about any of those books on this podcast. We have a reputation to uphold. We do not write about books that, you know, benefit people's work lives. That is not what we're here for.
Well, I just want to say, so far, I've been more impressed than I was expecting. I always thought a lot of these books were just someone trying to, like, be successful by selling you the concept of success. Some of them are genuinely quite good. Some of them are good. Some of them are genuinely quite good, like, here's a case study, here's some recommendations, why don't you apply this? I've also seen the other end, and it's just like, so, you've noticed that this rich successful person eats salad. Thought about eating salad? So they do run a spectrum, but I just wanted to share. There's a world of literature out there, people. What are you going to spend your time reading?
That's not literature, but yes. Okay. Duncan, would you like a stark comparison in what I've been reading?
Yes, I would love that.
So, I did not whiz through this book. There's your first hint about how I found this. I really dragged it out, and as such, and I also jumped back and forth between other things I was reading. So, in the last span of time, since our previous episode, I've read four books. Or rather, I've finished four books, including this one, and I finished three of them on the same day, which is unusual for me. I'm not really a bouncer between books, but this time I was. So, some of this has led to me having a slightly more sour opinion on Red Sonja, because in the last couple of weeks, I have reread and finished The Two Towers and Return of the King, which is not a very favourable comparison to Red Sonja.
No, but that doesn't mean, like, it's basically saying something isn't as good as The Lord of the Rings still leaves a lot of room for quality.
It's true, but one has to be sort of fair and reasonable. Now, I did also finish, like, a kind of, like, silly YA book in the same week. I finished reading Super Fake Love Song by, author's name added here,
David Yoon,
and that was, like, very silly and fun and not very legitimately. In the author's note at the end, he said, "The year is 2020, everyone is having a miserable time. I wanted to write a book that was kind of silly and fun, which would make people feel happy." And that's very admirable. It was much better than Red Sonja Consumed. Another thing I experienced in the past 2 weeks, I'll briefly go over this because, you know, this is a fantasy podcast. I have so much more of an appreciation for Tolkien now than when I read him as a teenager. I've been very controversial in the past by saying that I would rather read The Silmarillion than The Two Towers. I genuinely enjoy reading The Silmarillion more because it's sort of boring on purpose. And the second half of The Two Towers is just, like, unforgivingly boring.
I disagree with that take so darn much. I just want that put to record.
I understand. I truly do. I totally understand. It does have its good bits. It's just the sort of slam in the halt of momentum where you start off the book. If you've only seen Two Towers of a movie, you will not understand what I'm talking about. But The Two Towers is literally split in two. It's two different books. The first one is about Aragorn going to Rohan, restoring the throne of Rohan to glory and defeating Saruman's orcs. That's an entire book. It's an entire story, self-contained. It's an adventure. It's exciting. It's full of amazing, beautiful lines, especially from Gimli, who is so... When you read The Two Towers, you lose so much respect for the way they depict Gimli in the movies, because it's tragic. And then we go over to Sam and Frodo, and they're walking, and they're walking, and they're walking, and they're walking. They're talking to Faramir for a really long time, and it gets very exciting at the end and dramatic. But the pacing of it is really hard to deal with. And then, Return of the King, it uses the exact same style of pacing to amazing effect. The way the two stories are separated in Return of the King, where it's one half of the Fellowship, their entire story gets concluded just before the halfway point, and then you join Sam and Frodo again, and you play through the same period of time from their perspective. It's amazing! It's so amazingly done, because in the first half, Frodo's gone. You do not know what's going on with him. Obviously, I do. I've read the books before. You don't know what's going on with him. Imagine you're in the 1950s, 60s, maybe when it was by this point. But you're reading this book. You don't know what's going to happen to Frodo. You spend half of the last book having no idea what's going on with him. And they're acting just on the blind faith that he's alive. And the March to the Black Gate saying, Frodo may be alive, so we have to chance it. And then in the second half, all of that's paying off. You're seeing all the different victories that happen so far away, helping Sam and Frodo in a way, and it's amazing. So yeah, hot take from the fantasy podcast, Lord of the Rings is really good.
I just want to throw in there, in the defense of the latter half of the Two Towers, that's where I think you get the absolute finest Gollum and Sméagol content, and that alone redeems it in my eyes.
That's very fair, especially in the early part. So right when Sam and Frodo meet Gollum, and he undergoes this sort of transformation from Gollum to Sméagol, and Frodo literally places a curse on him, something that I think a lot of people probably don't appreciate about, is that Frodo is legitimately abusing the power of the ring to control Sméagol. And like, Sméagol's final reckoning, falling into the lava, not by being pushed, like in a movie, but falling in, is because he broke this magic oath, which Frodo imparts on him. It's literally like a punishment from God for breaking his promise to Frodo.
Lord of the Rings, man. Maybe one day
we will good, cover it. Really good.
In six parts.
Maybe. Also, I've been talking about so much stuff, but I had a lot to get through. One, I went to the theatre and I saw a play version of Frankenstein. Without question, the worst play I have ever seen.
Oh, no!
I love going to the theatre. I've seen a lot of theatrical productions. I've seen a lot of plays I did not enjoy. Richard II, Snoozefest. My God, this was bad. I was genuinely felt in pain. I got a stomachache at the end. First things first, the main twist they had on the original source material is that Victor Frankenstein was Victoria Frankenstein. That's not a problem in itself. I was actually quite intrigued. What are you going to change about the story? Because the horror of the story to Mary Shelley is a man is creating life instead of a woman. And he's being irresponsible with it because he didn't have to go through the pains of labor to create life. And so he abandons the child, blah, blah, blah. So how is it going to be different when you have a woman creating life? After all, that's natural. There's nothing unnatural about that.
They do nothing, don't they?
No, they do worse than nothing. They do a bad job. Because a bad thing to do would just be play it completely the same. Victor wants to create life. He's irresponsible. Oh, in this case, she's irresponsible about life. It has unintended consequences. Instead, so Duncan, what do you think about the character of Igor?
I mean, I can tell you now that Igor isn't in the original. In fact, I don't think he appears until the... It's not even the first film adaptation. That's a character called Fritz. Igor's like a Hollywood invention years and years later. But generally, they're...
That was very impressive, Duncan. Yes, well done.
Thank you. But yeah, I think of the characters like... Genuinely, it serves a function. Because in the film... In a filmed version of someone for Victor to get their words out against, because you're not given the advantage of their mind, so it's someone for Victor to speak to during the whole process.
Exactly. Now, instead, this time, so now it's Victoria Frankenstein. Igor is her university professor, and it's his idea to resurrect the dead. And he instructs Victoria, his student, in how to do it.
That takes away a lot of what I would say is Victor's whole character.
Yeah, and so when it's a woman, it has to be a man's idea to do this. It can't be Victoria's idea to resurrect the dead. It has to be the man's, because she can't have like the agency to make these decisions. She's not doing this because, you know, she has this blinding ambition to stand amongst the greatest scientists in history. She's not obsessed with reviving the dead. In fact, her mother only dies after she goes to university, not long before. I can't go into all the problems the play had because it sucks. And it's not like I could tell people to avoid it because it's like a tiny touring production. I just had a bad time. The second half had one interesting twist, which was that Victoria dies long before the end of the play. In the book, Victor dies right at the end after he's told the whole story. In this time, and he tells the monster's story, like, as it was conveyed to him by the creature. I say he's monster. I shouldn't use monster, it's creature. Oh, God, this movie's play is so bad. They named the monster at one point. That was terrible. You can't name them but creature. That's the whole point.
You just call them Frankenstein. That's okay.
Well, they don't call them Frankenstein. A little child finds the creature in the woods and teaches him language. Normally, that's reserved for an old blind man, but having it be a kid, that's fine. But the child names him Forrest. I was terrified there was going to be a run, Forrest, run joke when the villagers came for him, but thankfully that didn't happen. There's this horrible scene when the creature confronts Victoria and is persuading her to create for him a bride. And it just goes in circle over and over. They say the exact same thing to each other over and over and over again. I was writhing in my seat.
What Geordie doesn't realise is that they actually just forgot their lines and just got stuck in a loop.
I'm positive that the guy playing the creature is the playwright. I feel convinced of this. Because he's like the oldest member of the cast. And their previous production was... Actually, you know what? I'm not going to say that because I feel like if I gave too much information about the touring company, people could figure out what it is, and they're not serious actors. They are professionals, but they're not serious. But yeah, that's just a theory I have. I'll say the last and most offensive thing of all. So, at the end of Frankenstein, the book, the creature appears on the ship. It's the first time that he appears without being presented through the eyes of Victor Frankenstein. He meets with the ship captain and says, you know, my whole life has been a curse. I wanted my father to love me, and instead, he hated me so much he drove himself to my death. There's no way I can live in the world like this, where I'm so contemptible. Let me have my father's body, and I'll destroy both of us. I'm going to build a pyre and throw both of us onto it. And the ship captain lets him do this. He lets him take Victor's body away. In this... The creature, by the way, is much more villainous in the play than in the book, or at least in my interpretation of the book. He's definitively evil. He's got a huge body count at this point, and the captain, almost unprompted, lets him go and allows him to have Victoria's body for no reason. And then we cut to an additional scene, and the creature revives Victoria's body and brings her back to life.
Ew. How?
Yeah.
The whole point is that the creature doesn't know how to do this, otherwise he would have created his own bride.
Yes, that's right. So speaking of that, the reason why the creature has brought her back, and it turns out the reason why Victoria is Victoria and not Victor... is that the creature has brought... Yes, Victoria has brought the creature back to be his bride.
Ew. No.
Yes, ew. I was crawling in my seat when this was happening. Unfortunately, they don't go in that direction. Instead, she hooks both of them up to the electric diodes and shocks them both to death. So, which means the scene was completely pointless. It changes nothing in the book. And also the ship and everyone on board dies... at the end of the play?
I'm really sorry you had to sit through this because it does sound truly awful. And I'm sorry that Frankenstein the Modern Prometheus falls outside our wheelhouse as definitive sci-fi. Otherwise, I would love to analyse it to death with you. It was one of my like A-level books I had to study and I adored it.
Exactly, same for me. I love Frankenstein. Way better than Dracula. Dracula's good, but Frankenstein's amazing. It's very readable.
Yeah, I...
Okay, I talked about so much stuff. We're 20 minutes into the episode and we haven't discussed Red Sonja.
Should we discuss Red Sonja now?
Yeah, I guess.
Red Sonja Consumed is the book of the day, and it is another take on the character. I think it's very clear to see this isn't in sort of canonicity with any of the existing comics, although maybe there's a slight argument that Gales are most certainly pulling elements from her other works. So you can go in as a first read. Some people might be wondering about the other Red Sonja books at this point, because there were some written in sort of the late 1980s. Yeah, you can ignore them.
Sure, okay.
They do not matter either.
Yeah. Just like everything else in the Red Sonja, canon doesn't exist, as we covered last time.
But there are always...
It's very obvious, Duncan, that, as you say, she's gone back to the watering hole. Well, sorry, not the watering hole. She's gone back to the same well. The origin story as it's depicted is really, really similar. There's, like, she starts off all of the chapters with quotes from future historians who are writing about Red Sonja, or like quotes from folk tales of Hyrcania, and several of them are taken from her comic book. So she wrote like a poem or a song, and she just uses it again.
Which, in some respect, I actually quite like. It's something that actually is, it gives a nice little fluffiness to the whole canonicity issue. It's like, Red Sonja is a legend. There are many tales about her.
Yes.
You know, not all are true. Yeah. Maybe, you know, some flex with others. It's a nice kind of way to look at it.
It's also quite pretentious.
I did think that. I'll be honest with you, Geordie. After we got to about the halfway point in this book, I kind of started skipping over, particularly, so these are little written sections at the start of chapters, and I've read several books that do this. In fact, some of the early Conan works by De Camp used to do this, but what's quite interesting is that in those works, three sentences, that was a long one. Yep. These sometimes go on four pages.
I know, it's insane! That it's genuinely marvelous. I have I wanted to write one of my stories with like lyrics from songs at the front, and I was like, it's too much, man. It's too much. There are pages. So, Red Sonja Consumed. Let's briefly go over the story. It's doing two things at once. This is a story about Red Sonja sort of reckoning with herself. You know, it's at a certain point in her career where she's obviously been on the scene for maybe about 10 years. She's had her fun, she's had her great glory, she's famous, and she's starting to reckon with her awful reputation, and with her own personal damage. It's also a story about undead spider zombies.
And it's also, by about a third of the run, I'd say the runtime, the word count, just the origin story again. Like, we hit the same point.
Yes. There's genuinely only one difference. Two differences in the origin story this time. So, one, her little brother. She has a new little brother. Previously, she had two brothers. Now, she has three. And one of them is a baby. And he survives. And it turns out the entire massacre was just to get a random baby. That was stupid. That was really stupid. This book is quite stupid. In many ways.
So before we kind of walk through it a bit more, let's actually round up our kind of general thoughts on this. I agree, Geordie. This book was stupid, and in ways that unfortunately annoyed me more than entertained me, because I like stupid sword and sorcery. It's kind of my thing. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this book wasn't fun stupid. It was often more frustrating, with sort of illogical decisions from both, well, from all the characters involved, and just a sense of not taking the world, both taking itself very seriously, but not actually adhering to the world that has kind of been established. This is the Hyborian Age. This is an established setting, and it kept not actually treating it like that. It kept masking up distances and nations and geography and ruling classes, and it annoyed me.
I knew you were going to have more of a problem with this than I did, because at a certain point in the story, I feel like something that it's always struggled with is like, what is Hyrcania? because when I read, like, the rule books, Hikini is like, oh, it's like the Mongol Empire.
Yes.
They're, like, obsessed with horses, they're great archers, they range over steppes, but Red Sonja is the only famous Hikinian, and she's white. And eventually, I looked into it, and I'm like, okay, they're more supposed to be Cossacks as opposed to Mongolians. You know, they're still steppe people, but they are definitely white. Well, okay, I don't want to get into phrenological arguments, but in this, they certainly are. And so, obviously, they're more like Russian peasants, and they're horse riders.
Yeah. And I don't want to, like, throw this on Gail Simone. Like, obviously, she is free to reinterpret the setting how you like, but it certainly had more of a Western medieval vibe to it than I really personally kind of characterized this nation. It's the Hikanian steppes. Again, I've always read it as being more leaning into that kind of Mongol Empire interpretation. In fact, there have been other works that put sort of Genghis Khan style figures to originate out of Hikania. Like, those are the kind of characters that you see, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, and like, and in the like in the Arnold Schwarzenegger one, he spends time around Hikania and he comes out wearing like full-on Mongolian armor.
Completely. It's a very common interpretation.
He even quotes Genghis Khan, or Chinggis Khan, I guess.
Yeah. I don't see why this is sort of a challenging one. But, you know, Gail Simone isn't the first one to not follow that interpretation. There have been other writers, particularly in Red Sonja, that do lend in. Because, you know, you look at the character design of Red Sonja and you go, really? I'm going to put her in a, you know, Mongolia-inspired setting? She might stand out. I need to sort of find a middle ground in terms of geography here to make this work.
Exactly. Which makes some sense. If you are being like, oh, she's like from the Urals, you're like, okay, well, I guess that makes sense. She's based on like a Polish character, right? No, you even said she was like Ukrainian.
The original Robert E. Howard character was from Ukraine.
Alright, so yeah, that's a problem. I did notice like some other small stuff. Like, I remember two notes. One, Red Sonja insists on calling the Vilayet Sea a Great Lake. She's very dismissive about it being called a sea. And that's when I was like, have you seen the ocean? Like, why would you think it's small? It's not insignificant. And this is like the sea you grew up next to. Why would you think it's tiny?
Exactly. There should be nothing else larger as a reference point, unless she's been as far as, you know, the kingdom, you know, unless she's gone to Argos or Zingara and actually seen the ocean. But then that's the ocean.
Yeah, if you stood at the shores of the ocean and you stood at the shores of the Vilayet Sea, you wouldn't know they were different until you sailed out like 4 miles. And no, fuck it, you wouldn't know. Sorry. I don't know why I apologize for swearing. I swear all the time on this podcast.
Fuck yeah, you do.
You wouldn't know it until you sailed for like a week over and you didn't get to the other side. All right, that's a pet peeve. It just annoyed me. I felt it was the phrase Great Lake was very American. So it felt weird in a fantasy setting.
It did. It felt weird in this setting.
The other thing.
Oh, go on. Yeah. You hit another thing. I've got loads of other things on this topic. But these are things that, by the way, I appreciate.
The one thing I noticed.
If you're new to Red Sonja, you won't care. This is just because I love this setting, and Gail Simone keeps getting it wrong. But go ahead, Geordie.
So her village is raided by Kofians, and I was like, well, Koff's really far away. That's like Black Colossus stuff. That's not in like Turan or the Zamorin stories. So what are they doing all the way in Hikania?
Yes, this really bothered me. So we keep getting reference of this, like, these people from far afield, like Kothians are raiding their land. Now, to just get that in perspective, this setting is meant to, you can literally map modern day Europe and North Africa and bits of the Middle East onto the Hyborian map. And it's done. You can quickly Google this. And this is part of the setting that was inspired by the original author. You know, this is what he had in mind. And a lot of the cultures kind of lay on top of each other if you do that. Koth is somewhere in the vicinity of, like, well, it's kind of in the middle of the Mediterranean, but maybe Italy, if we're looking at, like, latitude. And
in terms of culture, you're talking about, like, I don't know, Libya?
Yeah.
Like, that's what the terrain would look like.
And, again, Hyrcania is literally around, like, Kazakhstan on the map, stretching all the way over to Mongolia. That is a huge distance to be travelling. And later on, this one really bothers me, she talks of a joint Zingarian and Zamorian, like, attack or threat. And you're like, Zingaria is Spain. And, like, Zamora is north of Greece. It's like Ukraine. Why are the Spanish marching the entire length of Europe through at least 4 other countries to go raiding into the steppes? I don't get it.
I didn't even notice that, but that is yeah. So the point there is that this isn't really like a Hyborian story. You know, this isn't set in the age undreamed of. It's the character of Red Sonja. The character of Red Sonja is on an adventure, and the terrain around her is what Gail Simone wants it to be. It's not a part of a greater universe, not a part of a greater canon. It's Gail Simone writes strong female barbarian, the book. So let us separate it from canon, from Robert E. Howard even. Let's just talk about it as a book. How does it work? Is it fun?
That is the question, and it is fun in bits, is how I describe this.
In bits, yes. There are definitely points where I went, yeah, this is fun.
So when we kind of follow this story, we open on Red Sonja fleeing a ex-lover, the queen of these people who she has bedded and stolen a value talisman, the Golden Asp, which is effectively a bracelet.
Mm.
She steals this, she's on the run, and this is where we kind of get the kick into her kind of moral reflection. You know, Red Sonja's thinking, hang on, did I have a genuine connection with this person who I slept with to carry out this theft? Hang on, this person was thinking about greater things, or, you know, building a nation, making people's lives easier. Maybe that's more worthwhile than just stealing and getting a bag of gold for my efforts.
Yeah, why did I even steal it? Do I even want it? Do I want the gold? What am I really after? So we get catching her at a sort of contemplative moment. And I will say this. Best moment in the story by far is the second time Queen... Every time I'm about to say a character's name for the first time in one of these episodes, I come into it with so much confidence, and then I completely lose faith. I want to say Yashana. Am I right?
Now you know what it's like to be me, where even if I say it with confidence, you correct me, and my confidence is shattered.
I'm sorry, Duncan. I'm sorry. Ysidra. Who the fuck is... Who is Yashana? That sounds really familiar. Ysidra is this barbarian queen who she's tricked, betrayed. She was in love with her, but she ran away from her own feelings. And when she catches up to her for the second time, they've had a physical confrontation, and now they have to have an emotional one. When Red Sonja really has to reckon and say to her, I'm sorry I betrayed you, I was afraid of my own feelings, and I'm ashamed of myself and who I am. That was genuinely the most interesting and the most effective part of the book.
It has a deeper moral complexity, which we actually don't often see in your stereotypical, typical sword and sorcery protagonists. I like that. I think you definitely, when you come to write a book about a character, Red Sonja, choosing trying to create this more depth to them is a great idea, because you're going to spend a lot more time with them. You've got the opportunity to flesh them out more than Gail Simone would traditionally have in her comics. Why not do this? Why not take the opportunity? And I think this is a really good decision, even if I feel the execution at points falls very flat.
Yeah, because there's not actually that much to this story. You know what? Actually, I want to rephrase that. There isn't much depth to this story. There is a weird amount to this story. there are a lot of different perspectives on the whole thing. There's maybe like five different perspective characters, some of whom are there for a chapter. You've got Red Sonja herself. You've got Isidra and her guards, their perspective characters. You've got Silas, who's the biggest waste of paper I've seen in a long time. You've got, like, the King of Hyrcania's court. And, I don't know, the bad guys? Oh, and, like, random civilians who are being killed by monsters. So it's a very sprawling story. Not very Conan-like at all. In that, you'd normally get two perspective characters, which is normally Conan or his paramour for that story. Or one guy on the frontier and his dog, if for now,
and even when you get into more modern Sword and Sorcery, quite a common trope that's come about is that you often will get the hero and you'll get a someone on the villain side, which has become weirdly common as a way of being like, okay, the hero isn't going to discover a lot of the complexities of what's going on. They're just there to hack the swords down. So I'm just going to give you a villain perspective so you can see the mechanisms before the hero just cuts through them all.
Yeah, the fact that there are so many perspective characters, they need to be there because there are a lot of different moving parts of a story. There's a lot of different elements sort of on trajectory. It's like how in an Expanse book, every single perspective character is super important because all of them are in the best seat in the house for an important moving element of the story. You got the main crew, so we need a perspective on them. We got one on the bad guy side, we got one on an ally side, we got one person who's going to make a crucial decision later in the story, so we need to have the emotions baked into, you know, oh my god, are you going to be able to make that decision? In this case, it was just so we had camera lenses, you know? We had moving fronts of where the bad guys are, and we need to know where and where they are. Every time the book cuts to Silas, Silas is basically a hitman under the employ of the Falcon, who's the guy who hired Red Sonja to steal the Asp. And his only job in the story is, even though he works for a guy to kill people, is to follow his personal motivations and go on misogynistic rants.
I'm sorry, I was just nodding like along, like vigorously in silence, and then realised the format of this show. Yes. And it's a really kind of bizarre choice, particularly for where this character goes. We keep cutting back to him, and you'll see him have an interaction. He'll have some misogynistic thoughts. He'll have some let's murderously kill people thoughts. He might then just kill someone in a cold-blooded way. But
actually, he probably won't, because he barely kills anyone. This is a huge problem I have with this book. Silas is supposed to be a menace, right? He's supposed to be a threat to the characters. We're supposed to feel tense when he's the perspective character because he's catching up to Sonja. But almost every single time he goes to murder someone, he's interrupted, and he fails to do so. I'm not joking about this. At some point of the story, I was like, maybe this is a joke character. You know, maybe he tells the audience that he's this amazing hitman and killer and a genuine threat to Sonja. And then when he shows up, Sonja will kill him in like two blows. And it turns out that it was all in his head. He was never actually good because he doesn't demonstrate his skill ever.
He just thinks about it and talks about it. It's a very unfortunate case of Gail Simone telling us something and not showing us something. And it just has this sense, go back to that Expanse comparison piece, because there's two key things about the Expanse which don't land here. And I know people might be like, that's a very unfair comparison, but it demonstrates what you sort of need to be doing when you have this very multi-perspective. And I think number one is they've all got to be interesting. I was reading Red Sonja Consumed, I was nearly continuously just like, can we just cut back to Red Sonja? Because you know what? She's the main plot. She's the only thing, the only character that's genuinely pushing us towards the conclusion. And the second thing, which I really feel like let this all down considerably when we were getting to the end, is that when you've got these multifaceted stories, now in Sword and Sorcery, you normally have like, it's quite simple, one plot. that go through to its climax. Okay, we've got multiple plots. Okay, that's a decision. How are they all going to tie together and have this multifaceted climax with all the threads interweaving? And I just feel like it doesn't. You deal with one threat, and then we deal with the next, and then we deal with the next. And you're like, this isn't adding. This isn't a case of the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. This is just, at most generous, sum of the parts.
It's a very disjointed story. A big part of that is the rehashing of the origin story. That probably feels like more of a waste of time because we just read Red Sonja, Queen of Plagues. Oh my god, there's another fake plague. Oh, I forgot about that. I genuinely forgot about that until now. So much is rehashed from that comic book. It really does feel like she had kind of one idea. You got an army of monsters showing up. There's a fake plague. Hyrcania is pretending that they're possessed by a plague because they're afraid that if the foreign nations realize that they are that they're weak, they'll invade. So they have to pretend to have a plague, and which leads to a bunch of Hyrcanians being like put to death upon them crossing borders. So great plan. And that was obviously a plot point in the Queen of Plagues. It was a fake plague. The same origin story. Almost exactly the same thing again. Only difference is that it's dragged out over a huge part of a story, and Red Sonja kills a bear with a big rock, which is not fair because I wrote a story about someone with red in their title killing a bear as a child, and I feel like I can't do that now because everyone knows I read this book.
And when looking at the origin story, because that's kind of a key component, and I feel like if you've had any prior exposure to Red Sonja, you have seen a rendition of this origin story. And the key elements are there. Red Sonja has an idyllic, sort of air quotes there, life. To a certain extent, she's rubbing up against it. She wants a bit more adventure. Her village is attacked. Her family is all killed. And she has to make this commitment to, I'm not going to like lie down and die. I'm going to learn to fight. I'm going to struggle. And I am going to go on and make sure this doesn't happen again. Was it better in this book than Queen of Plagues? It was longer.
I liked the section in the woods where she is surviving. I think that was okay. It's much less efficiently told. And it struggles from the fact that Gail Simone is not the greatest writer of prose. She's obviously been very successful as a comic book writer. And I feel like her inexperience, because this is her first prose book, is showing here. I feel like she's making mistakes that would not be expected of a writer of her genuine pedigree. At one point, it says she smiled a smile.
What does that mean, Geordie?
Well, it's a tautology. You don't need to say she smiled a smile. You can just say she smiled, or you could say in any other way, you know, you could express that differently. I'm actually not a big fan of just the word. I'm not a fan of the word smile. I feel like it's so easy to get it wrong.
I always feel like if you're going to write the word smile, it needs to be played out. Genuinely, I always have this feeling whenever I read someone smiling in a book, I feel like it's because they're drawing attention to it because it's one of those fake things. Like if a character's overly being friendly, the ulterior motive, then you tell me they're smiling or they want to hide something. Like
I won't go that far, but I will say that it's so easy to go overboard. That's what we talked about in the Rift War and how we were saying that people were constantly smiling at each other, and I hated it. I had a similar problem in this book. But she smiled a smile is ridiculous. If I was in an adult writing class and someone wrote, she smiled a smile, everyone in class would be like, you should really reconsider how you wrote this because it's bad. This is a professional writer who's been writing for decades. It's obviously, it's not a strong point. You can feel where her strengths come because she's obviously got a strong sense of the character. There are strong parts in the book where it's dialogue and, you know, she's just sort of being a cool, gruff badass. And it's very good at having Red Sonja be a cool, gruff badass. Not the gruffest or the coolest badass. This isn't like Joe Abercrombie stuff. There aren't any lines that make me go, oh, hell yeah. It was like, yeah, this feels like a corny action movie. probably one where we get, like, I don't know, 68% of Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, around that point. And I think that's kind of a shame, because I think there is some fun sword and sorcery to be had here. There's a particular section that I really enjoyed, where Vesonia, she's travelling into Zamora, she gets captured, and then we're in Gladiator.
Hell yeah. Classic.
Classic.
It's so obvious and kind of played out that Gail Simone even says, the last time Red Sonja had been forced to fight in the arena for her life. And I was like, yeah, I like that. It's so played out that Red Sonja has literally had to do this multiple times before.
Really fun section. You've got two enemies bearing down on Red Sonja, and you go through all the really strong points of that I like seeing a fight scene. You've got a character thinking on their feet. You've got them having sort of micro problem solving as the fight goes on. You've got Red Sonja sort of trying to mislay them, you know, use the fact that she's not maybe the most strong in that moment, or that she doesn't have the best weapon. She goes in with like this little rusty old sword to kind of lure them in. This is all really cool, as it was in Queen of Plagues when we read the comic.
That's right.
But it works.
It does work. It's functional. I do think that the fight is kind of let down because you're right. She wins because she outsmarts her opponents. She breaks her old rusted sword and creates like a tiny little jagged tip, and that's enough. And I can kind of see why Gail Simone basically ends the fight there, because Red Sonja immediately just stabs them both to death. I can see why. Like, the fight is won because she outsmarted them. On the other hand, you know, you want it to be a dramatic and cool fight, right? Can't we have a tiny bit more to and fro, a bit of tussle? There's only a couple of fights in this book where it's not, like, obvious who's going to win right from the start. And that is not one of them. I had my complaints about that. Partly because, you know, it is a bit played out, and partly because this exact same scene will happen again in Berserk, and it's done amazingly there.
It's also done in Attack of the Clones, an excellent gladiator arena. You should read that novelization
one day. Also done in John Carter of Mars.
Yeah, it was as well. Oh, it's a good setup. What I really like, though, about this section is that this section, we spend a lot of time just with Red Sonja and her perspective. We get the fight, we get her going back to her, like, refresh quarters. And then we get to spend a lot of time with Red Sonja. We see how she treats the jailer by smashing him in the bollocks. We see how she sees these sort of ghosts
that was good.
Of, you know, people she's killed and the sort of the trauma. I know it's partly magic from the bracelet she has, but it sort of kind of carries that point of, like, you know, this is what she's carrying, this is what she's kind of living through. And then it leads into introduction of new characters and this kind of fun escape scene and this slightly goofy person in a rat costume. It's focused, it's fast, and it works because it's very sword and sorcery. We're staying with our main character and they're doing a slightly fun adventure, but with these darker, poignant scenes filtered in.
Yeah, those sections, they do work. They are functional. That's definitely the time in a book where, on average, I was having the most fun.
So let's talk about something which I think goes back to the negatives now. If I think it works really well when it's focused, I think it works least well when we're going big. And one of the big things that's happening in this book...
You mean like...
Like multiple perspectives, like countries, like a spider zombie attack that's threatening all of Hycania, but they're sort of like the White Walkers. They can all be brought down with one simple dagger once the heroes arrives. But until that point, they're absolutely undefeatable. And everyone who's living an idyllic, perfect life is having it terrifically snatched away. You know, like that.
The magical elements. Obviously, I said before, let's not talk about Robert E. Howard, because he had, like, a strong sense of how magic exists in the world, where kind of magic was kind of subtle. There were demons and such. There were, like, wizards, but they were strange and distant and not really understandable. And even something like a giant spider was probably about the size of a Rottweiler. That's what a giant spider was. In this, it was way more, not even like Shelob, it was more like Dark Souls. That's the sort of like level of fantasy we're at.
I think that's a really good comparison. Particularly with the main villains being sort of necromancy. Well, there's two tiers of them, isn't it?
You just reminded me. That's right. There are monsters. This was not obvious, not clear to me at first, because they are monsters who can raise the dead. And at first you kind of think like, okay, so they're a zombie. They bite you and then you come back from the dead. Actually, the monsters themselves aren't undead. They're just controllers of undead. They are like, I don't know, they're just like white underground people. So like the monsters from The Descent, but they can see and talk. They're like an ancient, cursed, oppressed people from Zamora. And they can kill people and then they can just raise the dead, like White Walkers. They do have the absolute worst line in the entire book, where it completely takes you out and you stop thinking, I'm reading about an adventure, and you say, I'm reading a book by a hack writer, where someone says, die, demon, or something like that. And one of the monsters says, we are not demons. We are more like necromancers. And then raises his hands and brings back the dead. And you're like, that feels like a line that was written. It doesn't feel like something that anyone at any time, at any point in history, in any dimension would say. It feels like the dungeon master is reading the stat block off the page.
And you know what's really upsetting about that line is the fact that these monsters were once human. So it would be so much more powerful if they'd use that opportunity to be like, we are not demons. We were people like you. Like, I so thought that's what they were going to do.
That's a way better line, Duncan. Unironically, that's actually legitimately way better.
Thank you.
So, I thought you were going to say when you broadened the scope, was you going to talk about world building? Because this book is... Everyone who listens to the podcast know I'm not as big a fan of like world building. I don't find it to be virtuous or impressive. But I will call it out when it's bad. And in this book, it's really bad. Because it's so boring. Oh my god!
Geordie, obviously we try not to talk in the week.
A whole chapter!
But Geordie messaged me with this rant he's about to give you.
It was not a rant. It was a single line of text.
A lot of emotion
I'd have my phone to hand right now. I'm glad you felt the emotion, but I'm pretty sure I just said, oh my god, a whole chapter was just about a chair. And legitimately, that's almost true. A quarter of the way into the book, there's not a long chapter, but I'd say 90% of this chapter is legitimately just about why does the Hyrcanian king sit in a chair? And at the end of the day, this is actually about why the bad guys are the bad guys. It's like Hyrcanians used to be conquerors. But this is wrapped up in the most boring history textbook of... Once upon a time, Hyrcania had a grand golden throne, and the king did this, and then they conquered Zamora, and they ransacked it. Oh, but then the Zamorans and the Zingarans had their revenge. I assume that's when the Zingarans get brought up. I forget, because again, the chapter was so boring. And they were ransacked, and now they have a wooden throne. 90% of the chapter is about a chair. It's about a chair. And then at the end, there's a bit of dialogue. That should have been two paragraphs. It was genuinely offensive. That's why it took me so long to get rid of this book, because there's a lot of scenes where we go and embark on a long, extremely dull history of stuff which is not important. You know how the monsters are introduced in this book? There is the second chapter of this book is the entire story of a goat farmer's life. The entire story. It's about his relationship with his mother, it's about the crush he had on the girl in the village, it's about the death of his parents, it's about him growing up to be a man, it's about him feeling ashamed for jerking off, it's about him getting married, and then at the end he gets killed by a monster. And I did not need all of that to see this guy get killed by a monster.
So, I just want to make a comparison here.
No,
it's really bad.
I genuinely... I'm sorry, Duncan. I want to just get this out. First of all, I fell asleep during this chapter. That's legitimately true. I fell asleep and I had to go back and start the chapter again I listened to it on audiobook. The audiobook was shit. The actor behind it is Felicia Day.
That's a name I know.
I know a lot of people really like Felicia Day. I don't know why people like Felicia Day. I don't think she's a good actor. She does a really bad job in this. She's constantly mispronouncing things. Okay, what was I saying? Yes. We spent so much time on this guy. I was convinced he was the bad guy. And this was, like, his origin story. He was gonna, like, summon a demon. Or, like, unleash the horror upon the world. And instead, it was like, oh, he's literally just the first victim. That's all. He's not, like, the mastermind behind it all. I learned all this stuff about him for no reason whatsoever.
I knew there was a rant behind that single sentence message, and I'm glad we got it out of you. Do you feel better now?
Actually, I feel like I hurt my throat a little bit. I'm gonna be quiet and let Duncan talk for a while.
And this isn't a bit of a curious setup, because we actually get this several times throughout the book. But I'm focusing on the man's life and the monsters. I once read a first ever debut novel called Red Swarm, which I actually did quite like. It's about biological eels that grow giant size and attack people. Very sci-fi movie, but as a book. But in that, there would be scenes where you just cut to a new person in a chapter, and it'd be like an old couple going for a walk down the beach, and he'd turn to his wife and he goes, "I'm so happy that we got over the cancer diagnosis." And you'd be like, "Yep, they're dead," in like a paragraph.
Oh my god.
And lo and behold, two paragraphs later, they're dead.
Counter on the scoreboard. That is the first spit take of the podcast I was drinking partway through. Oh my god.
It's great. There's another scene in that book, like, again, you like, oh, turn a page, and it's like a two page and a half chapter, and it's like a classic case of two teenagers in their car about to do it, and you're like, okay, I see what you're doing. But anyway, what I'm saying is, that
great.
Was not an amazing... It can be great, because it's short. Respect my time.
Yes.
I get what you're doing. That the act of having these monsters be introduced by just callously killing like a civilian and giving that civilian a little bit of detail so you feel them, like, you know, it's not a statistic. These are people, these civilians. So you have an emotional connection when more die later.
Mm.
That works. Spending a whole chapter on it does not work.
Yeah. Stephen King can do that because he's really good at writing books.
George R. R. Martin. Nearly every single Song of Ice and Fire book, the first chapter is like a cold open where the prospective person dies. That's like the thing. And that works because it's a big, it's epic. He is a much better prose writer. I'd also say he's quite a good one.
Oof.
This is a short book. This is sword and sorcery. This should be hyper-focused. And for a book that doesn't take the established world-building and adhere to it with any real sense, I was not interested in hearing your half-developed world-building for this Red Sonja adventure. Are we getting a sequel? Is this the first in the series?
Apparently,
where
yes.
Will this go? Oh, flip.
We won't be reading that.
Oh.
Bad guys, not that interesting. The side characters that pop up, kind of annoying. Red Sonja's arc, pretty good. What else do I want to say? Okay, let's talk about queer stuff. So this book, I like the fact that Red Sonja is almost aggressively bisexual. She's not playing lip service here. It's not like in Queen of Plagues where a woman kisses Red Sonja, be like, oh, but did Red Sonja kiss her? Who can say? What was the relationship between these women? Was it sexual, or were they more like sisters of battle? Oh, no, no, no. Red Sonja is probably the most pansexual woman I've ever seen in a book.
And do you know what? Actually, hurrah to that. This is actually really refreshing to have Gail Simone be aggressive, be forward,
yes,
and make it a part of her character.
Yeah, she's a boisterous
in a meaningful
character. She's a barbarian. She eats a lot, she drinks a lot, she screws a lot, and she screws a lot with men and women.
Although it does give us a line, and this isn't an exact quote, but this is...
I know what you're going to say!
Key bits are here. And then I snuggled down into bed between his hardness and her softness.
Yeah.
I was like...
There's no part where it's like,
okay.
As he grew harder and she grew wetter, Yeah, so I Red Sonja, you know, I was not kidding when I said, like, she eats a lot, she drinks a lot, because she will refuse to have sex with one person at a time. It always has to be two people, just so there can be no ambiguity about about her sexuality. It's like, no, I always need more. I actually wasn't put out by the way the sex was written in these books. Those two lines you pointed out are a bit cringe, but actually, I kind of liked the way it was sort of handled. It felt like we were reading it in the abstract. It wasn't like A Court of Thorns and Roses. It wasn't like from Blood and Ash. You know, it isn't explicit smut. It's not dragon porn books. It was like, okay, I'm being described the type of sex is being had. Like, first they had like soft, slow sex, and then powerful, potent, athletic sex. And I was like, okay, well, there we go. That invokes enough of an image for me to get an idea of how this is going. What Red Sonja wants out of a scene. Yeah, fine.
And it's also just nice to have this be a facet of her character and not have to be a further plot point. This isn't really brought up. No one really, like, comments upon it. Mm. This is who she is. People get on board.
That's all we really got to say. You know, I feel like it does a pretty good job. It's one of those examples of, like, just writing queerness as just a thing that happens, not making a big deal out of it. And, yeah, I think it's functional.
And to be honest, it's a facet of the character that Gail Simone did bring in her comics. If you'd read the next story arc in Gail Simone's run, it does become a lot more explicit in that as well.
Great.
And I'll be honest, as a character, I think Red Sonja works really, really well. In fact, it's something that I wouldn't object to see on more stereotypical male sword and sorcery protagonists.
Yes.
I think it could be blended in incredibly easily. Some of them, I'm just like, come on. Aren't you really already? Why don't we actually explore this?
Elric and Moonglum, I know what you're putting down. I'm just saying...
How can you not?
Elric does not care about all these women he's sleeping with, but he really cares about Moonglum. Whatever, I've said my part. Alright. The conclusion
climax.
Of the story... Yeah, sure. After we talked about all the sex in the book, the climax, okay. The conclusion of the story is wonky. I have to say this. There's a very interesting phenomenon. Duncan, have you ever heard of Zeno's paradox?
I actually haven't. Please do expand.
Okay, so Zeno's paradox. Imagine you have a turtle. It needs to go from one place to another. But before it reaches the end point, it must reach the halfway point, right?
Yes.
But before it reaches that halfway point, it must meet the halfway point between those two halfway points.
Yes.
So no matter how close it gets to the end point, there will always be another halfway point in between.
Yes.
The logical interpretation of this means, the logical extension is, no two objects can ever touch, because there will always be another halfway point. And that's what the closing chapters of this book felt like.
Okay, well... Obviously, the halfway points are getting smaller, and this is where we have the notion of things tending to a number. 0.9 recurring tends to 1. It is equal to 1. But anyway, yes, that is the end of this book. I think I've heard of that in the Terry Pratchett, actually. Don't they shoot the turtle with an arrow? Anyway. Right. Yes, it does. This, like I said... This didn't, as I mentioned quite a while back now, this isn't threads being woven all together in a single tapestry. This is, we resolve one plot line, then we resolve the next, then we resolve the next, oh, then we have to resolve the next.
Yeah, it's a tick box.
So, Red Sonja travels back to Hycania. She is met up with these two lovely people, whose names I have forgotten, but they have very hard and soft sex together. She meets up with the Prince of Hycania, who, as we alluded to at the beginning, may be her long-lost brother. And we meet up with the Queen, and Silas is getting there, and you're thinking, and the evil necromancers, not demons, have attacked the capital, and they've burnt that wooden chair we heard so much about. and it's like, okay, all the players are converging on the Hycanian capital called Makalet.
Mm.
Which, by the way, is the name of the city which you visited, Geordie, in my Conan RPG.
Wait, where was the capital of Hycania?
It wasn't. The city was first created by Roy Thomas to be on the eastern side of the Vaelic Sea.
Yeah.
And it was actually its own independent principality in that setting. But they've made it the capital, whatever.
Oh, come on. We've both played a game where, like, there's a whole source books about different settings. Surely somewhere in there someone has said the capital of Hycania, or rather the largest city in Hycania, is such and such, right?
I am pretty confident there have been multiple capitals of Hycania in other Red Sonja comics, and it's never been this city. Nonetheless, it's the one we're going with.
That's weird. That just feels like an unforced error. Okay. The demons, they raid it. The prince rocks up in a way that is spiritually a lot like the arrival of the Rohirrim and on the plains of Pelennor, but they don't do anything because they just park outside the city walls and, like, we don't know how to do siege warfare because we are kind of Mongolians, and that's apparently we're not great at that. We have nothing to offer to get into our own city.
Genuinely, it's amazing. It's like, you're right, it's the Rohirrim rock up, they look at it and go, oh no, all the orcs are already in Minas Tirith. Oh, and they close the door. Oh, there's nothing we can do. Like, these guys try nothing. There's no, oh, there's a sewer grate, did you know? Or why don't we, you know, attempt to assail the walls? It's like, nope, door's closed. There was only one of them. Oopsie.
Oops. Oh my god, it's so embarrassing. Red Sonja sneaks into the lair of the demons and easily kills the head demon. It turns out it's very easy. I don't know why someone else didn't try it. And then subsequently, I will say this. I appreciate that the main boss gets taken out, and then they don't all just fall over like the droids at the end of Phantom Menace. I appreciate that. They kill the main leader, and it's like, all right, well, you still have to take care of the army. So they go down the line. Next, they have to take out the general. And next, they have to take out, like, just a big warrior. And they have to take out the traitor who let them into the city in the first place. And these are different things I have to take care of. I appreciated that.
I did like that. And something else that I liked in this scene particularly is, and this is, you know, filtered throughout the novel, but it really came to a head in this scene. One of the key aspects is that the Hycanians are excellent cavalry. They're great horse riders.
Yeah.
And Sonja has a real good relationship with her horse.
That's true, yeah.
I was taken aback by this, actually. In fact, I actually think this might be one of the better relationships in the novel. You know, she clearly cares. The horse clearly is invested in her. It's not Green Rider's level. Don't think I'm going to that point. Mm. But they work together and they fight together. She doesn't leave her horse, like, tied up at the entrance of this cavern. The horse goes underground into the demon mines and, like, attempts to, like, get up and trample the giant spider with her.
Oh,
and
my I'm god, like, I just remember.
You go, mate.
That, I mean, that's true. That was a good horse move. Very nice. I will bring up one thing I've mentioned before, which is that horses, famously skittish animals. I guess this is probably a war horse, so maybe it's been bred to be brave. There's a bit where they bring the horse down into the underground caverns, and I'm like, oh, first of all, don't do that. That's obviously insane. Like, it's going to trip, it's going to break a leg, it's going to die. And they keep saying, they're navigating using the horse's sight, like it can see. I looked it up, Duncan. Horses cannot see in darkness. They can see in dim light, but they can't see in darkness. They're not like
But they eat so many
cats.
Carrots.
Great point, Duncan. Good point. He's had a lot of carrots. He can see in the dark. Just weird. Why are you taking the horses underground?
Stupid. This is a key example, though, of that you're not being fun stupid. You've just been a bit stupid. Yeah.
So everyone who's basically important to Sonja dies. Queen Ysidra, they join back up together. Their relationship is shattered. They still love each other. And Ysidra goes to her inevitable doom, I appreciated the fact that they did. There was a good bait and switch. At this point, Ysidra has one guard left, and when they meet this great swordsman, who it's been noted is a great swordsman numerous times in the book, he makes his heroic final stand so that Red Sonja and Ysidra can move on. I will say this, very stupid final stand, because it's like, oh, Red Sonja would almost certainly take this guy out immediately because she's the best swordswoman in the world. Why is this chump going to be the guy to handle him? Why don't you all just kill him? It's 3-on-1. Anyway, and there's a bait and switch, because you're like, this guy's going to die heroically, but it's wrong. The book says it was the last time he would ever see his queen. Not because he's going to die. He's the only person to live. Ysidra's the one who dies. And that was a good bait and switch, I felt. I will say that that dude's fighting style is very stupid, because the way he wins that fight, he gets run through the belly, and then he bashes the guy who stabbed him to death against a wall, which I like. I like it when people are like, forget sword fighting, let's just let's just wrestle it out. That's why I like the Knight of the Seven Kingdoms so much. But that dude gets stabbed and then he's fine. He's literally fine. He got run through the stomach and he doesn't care. He's walking around.
It's barely noticed. In fact, he doesn't even have a like getting better in hospital scene.
Ysidra dies kind of pointlessly, because the whole point is that she's trying to like open the gate, and Silas stabs her in the back, and ultimately Sonya's the one who has to open the gate because Ysidra's dying, so she can't do it, which means that she actually didn't accomplish anything. There was no point in her being involved in the last part of the story because she didn't open the gate. She wasn't necessary to open the gate. Sonja could have killed the general and then gone to the gate and then opened it and nothing would have changed.
I mean, my only answer is yes. Red Sonja's established as being the greatest sword fighter in this entire setting. So it goes each way. Oh, I'll hold off this guy. You know, Sonja can kill him. Silas, Sonja kills him. The gate, Sonja opens it.
The weird thing is that
it's a very upsetting kind of sacrifice.
The weird thing about it is that the thing which Sonja says throughout the book is, I don't need anyone else. And that's her stated goal. And obviously that the whole point of the story is that's not true. She actually desperately needs other people because she's very lonely. But the book actually constantly reinforces that's correct, because she's the only person to actually resolve anything in the book. Which is fine. Like, you know, I wouldn't expect... You know, I was about to say it's fine because Conan does that. But that's not even true. Conan doesn't do that. Conan's constantly being saved by other people in the stories. And that's what works, is you have other heroes in them. Like Olivia in Iron Shadows in the Moonlight, or whatever that story is called. He has to be rescued. And that's one of the better stories, because it's not just a power fantasy about a big guy killing people with a sword. It's an adventure.
You really hit the nail on the head there, and that's where, like, that kind of strong thematic point, which so much of the novel is building up and working towards, just kind of disappears into thin air, because it's not the message that is actually delivered, even if it's the message that Gail Simone clearly is trying to deliver for the character. And again, it just comes off a little bit, I don't know, stupid, ill thought out. Like, this could have worked. You just needed to sit there and actually think it through a tiny bit more. I really feel like we're hitting on Gail Simone. She is obviously an amazing author and has done some incredible comics. I think her transition to prose clearly has been a challenge, and I'm sure she can develop further. And I'm not throwing her completely under the bus, but that doesn't mean that I can't slate this novel for all the faults I found in it.
The reason why this book exists is that Gail Simone has a strong pedigree. Agents and publishers are able to look at this work and say, well, Gail Simone has a fan base, she's a proven writer, we believe in her ability to write a good story and for people to buy it. If an unknown had written this story, even if they were sent it to, like, one of your pastiche publishers, going by, Duncan, what you said in your episode, yes, on the history of Conan fanfiction, the standards are not that high. I was about to say I don't think it was to get published, but you can probably disagree with me there. I'm sure this is better than a lot of those.
See, this is a really tough one to answer, and something that I am trying to kind of, like, explore myself. In many respects, this is better than some of the things I've read. The problem is, I think it's just a little bit too slow and clumsy.
Yeah.
To even stand up with the weaker ones. This is a story, and like we're about to mention, we haven't even gotten to the part that... So we have this whole demon fight.
Mm.
Okay, then we fight this general. Then there's a bit of talking. Then there's this standoff with the traitor, who we didn't really know was the traitor. Oh, don't forget Silas, who's been following about for chapter after chapter. Yeah, he's just brushed aside. It just kind of keeps going. You're like, this is overlong.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't needed. This isn't actually adding anything to the narrative.
Yeah. Remember the end of Empire of the Damned, where that was like split up into a bunch of different places? And the energy was so frantic and so desperate the whole time, but you're flicking back and forth across a whole battlefield, and every time you cut, you're like, oh no, I'm gonna miss out on that part of the battle, but I'm equally as invested in this other thing that's going on. And wherever you look, you're like, oh my god, there's so much in the air, what's gonna happen next? That's not how it's done here. It's a line of dominoes falling down. And actually, that sounds really neat and tidy. It's a series of tick boxes happening one after another. You said the most crucial thing you can about this book. It's slow. I wanted a whole thing about the philosophy of turtles, but it was said, best of all, and there's a reason why I kept bringing him up in this episode, by Stephen King. At the start of this episode, Duncan, we were talking about the map. So I went around looking for my Conan omnibus. I couldn't find it. It turns out my girlfriend had propped up a fan next to our bed, and had used the Conan omnibus to elevate it to the right level, because it's a big book. So I found it. After I had checked the relative distances of Koth to Hyrcania, I threw it down on the bed. And the back cover looked up at me, and it said, a quote from Stephen King, "Howard was the Thomas Wolfe of fantasy, and most of his Conan stories seem to almost fall over themselves in their need to get out." That's amazingly said, and it could not better illustrate what is wrong with this book, and why it is not a good sword and sorcery story.
I mean, I'm so happy that Stephen King could, firstly, when you're giving praise and it is as well written as your own work, top tier.
Yeah.
What a great description, and what this story was lacking in the moments where it was going fast, like the gladiator sort of arena section. I'm like, oh yeah, we're rolling, we're going. But then we cut somewhere else. We spent ages with a wooden chair, with an origin story, with a city that's being attacked by the necromancers, with no characters we've ever met before, who we don't need see since. We didn't need to actually see that siege. It's like in the Disney film Mulan. You don't need to see the village. I can't believe I'm referencing this.
No, yeah.
There's a scene in that film where Mulan, they come across a village that's been burnt.
Yeah.
We don't see the village burn.
No.
We just find it as the main characters. And you know what? You can find a cute little thing in the village, like someone's dog, just something to bring home the humanity.
Yeah.
That's all you need.
Exactly.
Not that the governor of the city was quite a nice chap.
Oh my God,
he made some deals. How his investments were doing.
That's right. I forgot about that. I'm going to say one more thing about this book, and that is, we've talked about a way in which it's not really like a sword and sorcery story in its tone. It has no interest in actually fitting into the Hyborian Age. It's not interested in making any kind of connections, and I know to a certain extent, as you said, for rights reasons, there are things it can't touch, but at the end of the day, it just doesn't feel like a sword and sorcery. And the thing in it that actually genuinely left a sour taste in my mouth is the very end, in the way that Red Sonja uses magic. The Golden Asp is nebulously connected to the threat, the undead necromantic threat. And it has its own necromantic powers. It can summon up the spirits of the dead, much like, say, Corum's Eye. And then you can command the dead. So it's similar to how the bad guys use it. In the one scene, Sonja uses this power to summon up Ysidra in order to have one last conversation with her. So in this way, the necromantic powers are being used as a symbol of her coming to terms with her trauma. You mentioned before that Red Sonja's trauma was represented by her being hounded by the ghosts of those she's slain, and that, you know, that's, we're having a reflection. It's literally happening because she has the bracelet, but it's actually a reflection of her psyche. In this moment, she's speaking to her lover for the last time. She has a long, hours-long conversation with her ghost, and then she lets her go. And then after that, she somehow manages to remove the bracelet, even though it was magically attached to her arm, and then destroys it. That feels poignant, right? That feels complete.
Yes, she's had this option, this dark magic that could connect her to her lover, but she's seen the greater good, she knows the role she has to play, so she's making a personal sacrifice to protect the rest of the world. How heroic, how poignant. Well done.
That's all she does with it, right?
No. Oh, I don't want to have to remember this
bit. It's just... Red Sonja discovers that, one, the Prince of Hyrcania is actually her little brother, who has a name. He does, it's true.
Good for him.
Yep. And she discovers that he's actually her missing brother because the king didn't have an heir, so they had to go get him a random baby. Now, they could have had any random baby, anywhere, for any reason. But they specifically chose to go and massacre a village and to steal a baby. And she finds the general who led this army of Kofian raiders. He's Hyrcanian. And she confronts him and says, I recognize you. You're the one who ransacked my village. And he said, yes, I didn't know it would be so violent. I really didn't. I didn't stop them. You're right. And I pay for that sin every day. I can't ask for your forgiveness. And Red Sonja says, I can't forgive you, but I'm not going to kill you either. So in this way, once again, Red Sonja is drawing she's drawing the curtain on her trauma. She's choosing to not live out vengeance. She's choosing to move on. And then, later, unprompted, she's like, why would that one guy, turn traitor? Well, he must have had someone telling him to turn traitor. Oh my god, the commander. This is after the story has concluded, by the way. Like, everything is neatly buttoned away. And then she has a revelation about the story, which is that this general is actually the one who was behind it all the whole time. He's the one who summoned up the dead. He's the one who did this. All because...
Yeah, thank you, Georgie. I'm waiting. Hyrcanian
needs
really waiting.
To be strong. So, the way we need to do that is summon up an army of monsters who we have no ability to control, let them destroy a sizable part of the capital, kill the king, so that the prince, who's next in line and who I have control over, can come to the throne. Now, bear in mind, nobody else, there's no other heir to the throne. No one else is going to challenge the prince. So if the king slips down the stairs one day and cracked his head open and died, that guy still would have come to the throne. And the thing is, you know, if the king had just died, the country would have destabilized and the prince would be seen as weak and there would be revolt. I think the prince is going to be seen as more weak when there's barely a country left and the capital is like being razed to the ground and there are thousands of people have been slain. I think they're probably going to think you're more weak now, even though the prince is the guy who helped save the day.
Was the strategy to summon up the monsters so that the prince could defeat them to prove strength? Because that didn't appear to be the plan either.
Duncan, I think it was so he could pass the Patriot Act. I made my joke about the Patriot Act because the plan is so stupid that it does remind me of, like, conspiracy theories. Like, Red Sonja comes up with this idea. She has no proof. She just thinks this. There's nothing that connects it. There's nothing in it, aside from the fact she hates this guy. There's nothing that she can say, like, aha, yes, of course, and I can put two and two together and make four. She guesses, and so she uses the power of the bracelet and invokes the dark magic, summons up dead zombies to kill this guy in his bed, and then after that she destroys the bracelet. And it is so off-color to have the hero of your sword and sorcery story, who is not called Elric of Menibone, use dark magic. Like, Elric of Menibone being a sorcerer and summoning demons was like the deliberate inversion of the barbarian hero, like Conan.
It really bothered me. It undermined her walking away from revenge. It was her making incredibly stupid leaps, which I believe the author intends for us to take as completely factual. But when you think about it, Red Sonja doesn't know that. Mm. Again, just stupid. And then the use of the dark magic, it kind of flies a bit in the face of the character that we've been established so far. You know, this isn't her style, her approach. It seems like something that should come with much more weight, the decision, but it's so tossed aside at like epilogue stages of the whole novel. You're like, why have you left me with this just ashen taste in my mouth? It almost makes me think that you've not got the same hold on the character I thought you did, or that the version of the character you want to put forward is now no longer the type of character that I'm interested in following. And it just...
It was just an unforced error. Like, it doesn't feel like you wouldn't expect Conan to cast a magical spell. That's just not what you expect. Obviously, this character's not Conan, and I don't have as much exposure to character Red Sonja. I just didn't really expect it, and it feels wrong. It feels like, well, it doesn't seem like something she'd do. Anyway, I think that's everything I have to say about this book. I'll reiterate this, because I didn't make enough hay out of it. The audiobook is genuinely dreadful. I don't think Felicia Day is a good actor. I've never seen her be good in anything. The thing she is most famous for, in my book, is accidentally creating Critical Role, which completely exceeded her expectations for how successful it would be, and then completely separated from Geek and Sundry. So another unforced error there. She does a bad job with the male characters in this book. She's not good at doing masculine voices.
I feel like, to kind of draw the curtain on this, this felt like a book that some people in suits thought would appeal to a certain audience. And I have to say, I bought it, so in some respects, well done. I really hope that if Gail Simone wrote this because she wants to pursue prose and really loves the character, because I do believe she loves Red Sonja as a character, I can only kind of say I hope that this is a lessons learnt and that we see some real kind of development going forwards. Because Gail Simone can tell a good story. There are hundreds of comic books to attest to this.
I doubt it's hundreds.
But this first prose novel just didn't land for me. As Red Sonja, as Sword and Sorcery, as just a fun fantasy adventure, it was a miss.
I gotta say, I was laughter Queen of Plagues. I was thinking, yeah, I'll go ahead and I'll read the next ones. I don't think I'm gonna do that now. It's kind of really spoiled, really,
Oh, that is heartbreaking. No! I was worried that would happen. I really want to emphasize, they are better than this.
Okay.
Like, there is so much joy to have from the character of Red Sonja.
Now,
if this book has put you off,
it has.
Then I change all I've just said. Damn it. Damn it to hell. That is not the answer. That is the worst thing this book could actually do. And I am worried that people are going to see this prose novel, have this as their entry point, and then never explore the character further. Because there is so much sword and sorcery fun to be had with Red Sonja. It's just not here. It's in the pages of Dynamite and Marvel Comics.
Duncan, it's time to move on. It's time to move on from Red Sonja until, of course, we watch the movie and then have to talk about it at the start of an episode. But we're never doing an episode on Red Sonja ever again.
I'll shake your hand on that.
Next time, Fufford and Grey Mouser.
Well, what is next time, Geordie?
Well, okay, so to draw back the curtain somewhat, we had to delay the release of this episode, the recording of this episode, for logistical reasons. And so, unusually, I had to tell Duncan what the next book was ahead of time. I've started reading it. I chose... Actually, should I say now? The important thing is, I chose a book. I've started reading it. Duncan ordered it from the library. You tell the story, Duncan.
I ordered it from the library because I don't want to give any more money to Jeff Bezos than I already do on a near daily basis. And I want to support my local library. So I went there. They didn't have it. I ordered it. I paid a fee for it to be delivered to the library from another library within the group. I went in today to collect it because I got an email. And it was not there. And a very nice woman, we went all the way around the fantasy section and into the ordered section where they have the books. And we have to conclude that someone came in, saw it in the ordered section with my name on it, and promptly left with it. So they've kindly put another copy on order. But it means that because we want to, you know, not feed the capitalist machine, we may have to take a little bit longer for me to get my copy.
I'm gonna have to edit out all of Duncan's criticisms of Jeff Bezos when one day we get that Audible sponsorship. For the record, I
and
think his,
I cannot wait
his head
day.
Is beautiful and wonderfully shiny.
Oh, when he's standing outside his spaceship and the light just dying light, the dawn light just gleams off the top. Truly. Chef's kiss. So, where does that leave us? Well, Geordie has very kindly said that we could swap picking the next books. So I shall pick another story, and Geordie will then get two in a row.
Hooray! Yes, and...
Yay!
Now, I made Duncan not tell me, because we had to violate the premise of the podcast where you guys get to find out at the same time as me once for this, so I've asked Duncan to not tell me until this moment, so I do not know, but it has to be a short one, because we need to do it in a week. So Duncan... what is the next book, and can I get it from my local library?
Okay, I'm going to tell you what the next book is, and I want to tell you, Geordie, I genuinely decided on this, like, 2 hours ago. This was locked in before we started recording. This was my decision. I haven't changed it, but it is Ill Met in Lankmere by Fritz Lieber.
Oh, So it is Fuffit and Grey Mouser?
Yes, it is.
Oh my god. Duncan, we've done so much sword and sorcery. Seriously? Okay, fine. We'll do it.
Because we need to remember why we like it, and I want to hold up a golden example.
Okay, fine. Fine. Okay, we'll do it. I was joking. Duncan, I was literally joking about... Fine. Okay. Tell me the story's name again.
Ill Met in Lankmere.
Okay, I'm sure that's not how it's pronounced. You can send it to me in text, but isn't that Swords and Deviltry? Isn't that the one you've been saying you want to read?
Yeah, Swords and Deviltry is a collection. Ill Met in Lankmere is a short story within the collection.
Right, okay. This has been on the to-be-covered on the podcast since day one, folks. I literally think this is the first thing Duncan wrote down.
And I'm really happy to finally look at it and wash this sort of ashen sword and sorcery taste out of our mouths with the fine wine of Fafnir and the Grey Mouser. Geordie, you're going to have to help me so much in pronunciations next episode.
I'm actually going to struggle because it's obviously in the name, I think, Fafnir. I've only seen it written down. I've no idea how it's supposed to be pronounced. It's obviously supposed to be a reference to, like, Fafnir from the Saga of the Volsungs, but Fafnir is actually pronounced Fofnir, so I've no idea what Fufud is supposed to be. It might even be, like, Fufuth.
Fufud. Fufud and the Grey Mouser.
When it's a DH, it's often a Th sound, so it might be Fufuth.
I look forward to truly exploring this with you. Next time.
Maybe it's pronounced Kirky. I'm going to stick to that.
Right, that has been Red Sonja Consumed. If you have experienced this book or the Red Sonja comics or anything else by Gail Simone, maybe you've watched the recent movie, share us your thoughts. This is the end of our Red Sonja adventures here on the podcast. Are you upset at that? Do you want us to do more? Let us know. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, Is This Just Fantasy Podcast. Send us some messages, like the post. We put up extra little reviews from time to time on there as well. It's the number one place to reach out to us, and it means a lot when we hear from you. The other next best place is on our Gmail, isthisjustfantasypodcast@gmail.com, when you've got those longer messages that you need a couple of paragraphs to fill out. send it over there, and you can also catch us on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. I always worry that people hear me say Just Fantasy and they think I'm saying it's called Fantasy and Just as part of the, you know, not Is This Just Fantasy. That's the title, Just Fantasy.
Can you say at Just Fantasy?
At Just Fantasy.
The problem there is that it's not at Just Fantasy because it's like, because on Blue Sky, the usernames are crazy. It's like at, it's at Just Fantasy dot Blue Sky dot whatever. I've been your host, Jordy Bailey. Let's get out of here.
And I've been your host, Duncan Nickel. Till next time.
So long.
Bye.
Bonus track. What?
So, Duncan, another thing that's happened recently is really big news in my personal life, which is that I have finally, after a long time, got my official diagnosis for ADHD.
Oh, I'm really happy to hear that. I hope this has helped you in life. Like, I know a lot of people who get diagnosed later in life, it can mean a lot just to kind of have an understanding. How's it been?
Well, yes, the process? Yes and no, because ahead of time, two different people, one of them was like, you know, when I was going for my autism diagnosis, the day before, I was so nervous because, like, what if it's all in my head and it's and it's not real and they're just going to tell me that it's all fake? And I was like, well, I'm not worried about that because it's so obvious that I have ADHD. So I'm not worried about that. And second of all, because you have autism in your head, that's where it lives.
I really didn't want to say that, but as soon as you said that, I was like, yes, that's the way for all of us.
That's how it's it. But no, I was not worried about whether I had it or not. I was going to that meeting, I'm like, I'm gonna flex on this guy so hard with how hard it is for me to read emails. But the thing is that afterwards, it's really great to have someone say, yes, I, a doctor, agree, and I'm going to give you your diagnosis, and in 7 days, I'm going to write you a thing that you can take to HR. That feels great. But then you have to wait for 7 days, and you're like, oh man, nothing has changed. I know it's true, but I can't prove it to anyone yet, so it doesn't actually impact the way I have to do my work every day. I still suck at doing the laundry. But the reason I bring it up in a funny way is that today, my girlfriend and I are out in the town. We're about to come home. She says, I'm going to get you a treat. And I went, okay, cool. And so she takes me upstairs to the second floor of the shopping center. And she shows me a storefront that is being used to raise knowledge about, like, brain stuff. It's a Lego event. People are building Lego. My girlfriend loves Lego. And cool. The moment she's like this, I'm like, oh, this is something you want to do. That's fine. And then she's like, I'm paying for both of us. And she goes straight up, pays her, and I'm like, oh, God, she paid for me. Now I have to do it. And it turns out the event is like, you have to put together a complicated model of a neuron. And if you want, they can time you and you can try and beat the record. The record was 3 minutes and 48 seconds and was done by a 9-year-old because, Duncan, everyone here except for us is a child.
Okay.
So now the heat is on because Lucas can do it in 3 minutes and 48 seconds. So we're like, well, we can take down this 9-year-old, no problem. So here's the deal. It's the same week I get my official diagnosis for ADHD, and now it's follow the instructions precisely and put together this intricate model right now, and you have to do it better than the 9-year-old. So it was very frustrating to be like, I can't do it. This is hard.
So you need to take that letter to both HR and your girlfriend.
Well, she's very supportive in every other way. She was just so excited to do the Lego because she did it twice. She made it once and then she was like, now I'm going to do it fast. And she took down Lucas. She did it in 3 minutes and 41 seconds. So take that, Lucas, you sack of trash.
Okay. Just a few couple of things. Firstly, again, I'm really happy for you, mate. I hope this really helps you and, like, you can now kind of get that extra support in sort of all aspects of your life. I have a diagnosis of autism. I actually now, in hindsight, really do have to give a lot of, you know, admiration to my mum, who kind of really took the education system to task and got me a diagnosis when I was, like, 8 years old. But this has all made me realise one key thing when you mentioned about finally getting a letter to take to HR, is that I've told many HR departments that I have autism and they've never asked for further evidence from me. They've just gone, yep, of course you do.
Like, we'll make a note. Sure. Do you want to join the leadership book club? Oh, now it has to be in this episode because I can't just put it into a future episode because that only works if you listen to this one. Okay, it's going to the end of the episode. I'm not sure where I'm going to put this, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be at the end of the Red Sonja Consumed episode. And if you're hearing it elsewhere, Geordie just stopped caring.
Okay, cool. End of the record.